All right, so we're going to start talking about the book of Isaiah this evening. And guess what? We won't even look at a single verse in that book tonight. Here's why. In order for you to understand the book of Isaiah, in order for us to be able to understand what's going on, we've got to get a background and some history of this book. We've got to be able to understand the time frame in which it's taking place. We've got to be able to understand and know some of the characters and what was going on between them before we jump into this book. There is so much in the book of Isaiah. There is a lot in here for us to pull out, and it's a lot for us to talk about, a lot for us to dissect. And we need to know what type of animal it is that we're about to grab a hold of, okay? So we're going to talk this evening about the background, some of the theology and the settings and those types of things related to the book of Isaiah. So I want to talk to you first about the time periods of history in which this book covers. There are three time periods. If you've got notes, you can there's spaces there for you to write on some of these things that I'm about to tell you. This book actually takes place over three separate time periods, three interesting parts of history in the history of Judah and the history of Israel. The first time period, as you can see there, is 739 to 701 BC, and the chapters that cover the majority of that are 1 through 39. Now, you have something interesting that you've got to go back and remember before you start looking at Isaiah, because Isaiah, you have Israel, the kingdom has now been divided. About 930 BC is when that happened, and so you have Israel in the north, you have Judah in the south, you have two separate kingdoms, two separate kings, and then you have all these different nations that are around them, and I'm going to show you on a map what this looks like so that we know kind of what we're looking at here. Now, let me see if I can make this happen. Here we go. All right. Okay. So I'm going to show you this map right here. Can everybody see that? That's kind of the words are kind of blurry. I've got another map I'm going to go to in just a second so we can clear it up and talk about some specific places. But I want you to see in green, that's the nation of Israel. And in pink, that's Judah. So this is kind of what the kingdom looked like after the death of Solomon when it split in 930 BC. That's the way the region was divided up. Now let me show you another map. This one's a little bit larger. There are some places that we're going to talk about that you're going to need to know where they are. So there's Israel. Watch this, y'all. This is so neat. Boom. I love it. So there's Israel. And then to the south here, and it's kind of hard for you to see on the screen there in color there. Great, now everybody's seeing my emails come in. So Judah down here in the south, and there's some other nations that you need to be aware of as we talk about Isaiah. There is the nation of Assyria, which would have been up here in this northern part, up this way. So that would have been the nation of Assyria in the north. Then you had another nation that's going to come into play, and not only comes into play in Isaiah, but comes in and figures in big to the history of both Judah and Israel, and that would be the nation of Babylon, which is back over this way. So you had Assyria to the north, Babylon would be back towards the east, and then beyond Babylon, further back out over here in this corner, back out that way would have been Persia. That's another nation that's going to figure in. So that's three nations already on top of Judah and Israel, right? Assyria, Babylon, and Persia. They're all going to figure in. There's one more that we need to know about. And that's the one that lies over this way. Can anybody take a guess? Egypt, that's right. The nation of Egypt. All of those nations are going to come into play in what we're going to be talking about here in the book of Isaiah. Let me see if I can draw this down a little bit for you to kind of get a better picture of what's going on there. So Israel, north of Judah, north of Israel is Assyria. Back off to the east, we have Babylon, and even further out than that, we have Persia, and then back off to the west, we have Egypt. Okay? So that's what our map looks like. That's what we're going to be looking at, the area that we're going to look at, and you've got a visual for it. And let me turn this off. There we go. It's gone now, right? Good. You don't get to see all my secret stuff. So 539 to 701 BC, keeping these nations in mind, let's talk about how some of these came into play and figured in to the time of Isaiah and what we're going to be looking at in his book. So for about 75 years leading up to this period in 739, the Assyrian Empire began to expand. They went through this rapid expansion. Their home was in what would be northern Iraq today along the Tigris River. That was kind of the central hub of the Assyrian nation. So they began to expand. They started expanding down towards the south, coming down towards the Persian Gulf, even going westward over towards the Mediterranean, and that starts putting pressure on the nation of Israel. That's important. So they're putting pressure on the nation of Israel, but while they're doing this and they're expanding, coming down south, they went through a period where there were a lot of weak rulers in the nation of Assyria. These were guys that just weren't quite able to push forward the expansion and the conquering of some of these territories like they wanted to. And they got caught up and hung up on this expansion, and it brought kind of a political peace to the area. And so there was some relief that was given to Israel and some relief that was given to Judah that they weren't going to necessarily have to hold these guys off. And so when that time comes, King Uzziah, which is the king that is going to be mentioned in Isaiah chapter 6, he's the one that is ruling Judah at that time. So while the political climate at the beginning of his kingdom might have been good, there were some things that were going on spiritually in Judah and in Israel especially that were not good. You see, Israel and both Israel and Judah, their spiritual situation, they were actually referred to by a couple of prophets as prostitutes. If you read in Hosea 1, chapters 1 and 2, and Ezekiel chapter 16 through 23, that's the way these two prophets refer to these nations during this time. So there's some overlap going on here, okay? There's overlap with the book of Isaiah with several other of the prophets, and also with 2 Kings and 2 Chronicles, you're going to see some overlap there. There's some things that are going on simultaneously with what's happening in the book of Isaiah. Sometimes we tend to think about the Old Testament and we tend to look at books as, well, this book happened, and then this book happened, and then this book happened, when that's not the case at all. Especially with these prophets and these books that give us historical accounts, there's a lot of it that overlays one another. And there will be times when we're teaching through Isaiah that I will refer you to other books so that you can read and see what's going on while these things are happening in Isaiah. And so the spiritual condition of these nations at this time was not good at all. They had, being called prostitutes, it was a pretty harsh thing, because what you're basically saying is that they were selling themselves out to others for gain. They had turned away from God and had stopped being obedient to Him and were making allegiances and giving themselves over to other gods. And so that's the spiritual climate at the beginning of the book of Isaiah, and even in King Uzziah's time when he was reigning, that was what was going on. Now, the political climate took a turn for the worse. So Assyria gets a new king in 745 BC. I love these Old Testament names. Are y'all ready for this? Tiglath-Pileser III. So you can keep that one on your list of baby names if you're looking for baby names. You can call him Tig for short. So he comes in and he's determined that he's going to expand the Assyrian kingdom, and he's going to take Israel and he's going to take Judah. He's going to expand this kingdom on out. So now remember our map. Israel is located north of Judah, and they are the first ones that are going to feel this pressure from the Assyrians coming down. Now, in that demographic, the geography of that place was such that they had to fear attacks from the north and from the south. Because let's remember, on the west, what was to the west of Judah and Israel? Huh? Okay, Egypt, but there was a body of water, the Mediterranean Sea. On the east side, there was this huge desert. And then before you, if you crossed that desert, before you got into Judah or to Israel, you had to come over a set of mountains. So they had a natural barrier on that side. Does anybody know what that's called today? They still fight about it. Okay, Golan Heights is part of it, but there's a specific name, the Palestinians and the Israelis today. It's one of the things that is very contentious there. It's the West Bank. If they lose, that's why Israel does not want to give over to that Palestinian state, because if they lose that territory on that side, they lose a natural barrier that helps prevent armies from just coming and sweeping into that valley and coming into Israel and coming into where they are. And so that's still a point of contention even today. And so with this natural barrier, the way the geography is there, they had to worry about these attacks coming in from the north. Well, Judah knew that Israel was going to be first. So Israel starts feeling this pressure from this Assyrian king, and they caved. Their king at the time was a man named Menahem, M-E-N-A-H-E-M. You can read about this in 2 Kings chapter 15. So he caves and he pays tribute to Assyria. So now what's happened to Judah? Their buffer to the north is what? Is gone. Assyria has got Israel. They've got an alliance with Israel, and their buffer is gone. And so when all this goes on, Ahaz, who is Uzziah's grandson, he comes in onto the throne about 735 BC. And with all this pressure, he adopts this foreign policy, this pro-Assyrian foreign policy, because he's afraid he's going to lose his kingdom. And so he thinks the best thing that he can do is to befriend them. So Judah begins to pay Assyria for help. Now, there's one commentator that I read that I thought this was a very interesting way to put this. He says that Judah paying Assyria for help was about like a mouse paying one cat to help him against another cat. Ultimately, in the end, the cat's the only one that can be the winner, right? So that was the political climate that had changed and the way things had gone. And so with all of that setting up, that starts Isaiah's public ministry. You're going to see when we get to chapter 6, where Isaiah has his vision from God and his call, and he comes in, then he begins having a conversation with King Ahaz, and all of this stuff that we've just talked about is lined out. All the historical accounts of it are lined out in those first few chapters of Isaiah. And so that's the start, that's the condition in which Isaiah starts his public ministry. And so as this political climate keeps going on in this time period, remember, we're still talking about 739 through 701 BC. As this continues to play itself out, Hezekiah, you guys remember his name? You've seen him before? King Hezekiah. You can read about him in 2 Kings chapter 18 and in Chronicles 29. There's some things there about him that are actually really interesting. He seems to have been a good king. He tried to, to rebuild the temple. He tried to, clear the temple of pagan worship and to bring the people back to Mosaic law. That's one of the big things that he tried to do. So he seems to have been a good king. He took a different approach to foreign policy than his father did. He was not pro-Assyrian. And so he wants to make Judah great again. Once he kind of realized that Assyria was not really going to be a friend to Judah, then he starts looking for a different ally. Now, out of the nations that we've talked about, does anybody want to guess who he looked to? Remember, we have Assyria, we have Babylon, we have Persia, and we have Egypt. Which one do you think he looked to? Does anybody know from Scripture? He looks to Egypt. He turns to Egypt to make an alliance with them in order to try to hold off the Assyrians. And so when they did that, the Egyptians were not quite as helpful as they had thought or they had wanted them to be. They weren't quite as committed to it as they would have hoped for. But ultimately, in the end, they were able to hold the Assyrians off, and the Assyrians never were able to get to Jerusalem and take Jerusalem. Now, if you remember the map that I showed you, Jerusalem is on the northern part of Judah. It's on the northern border of Judah. And so they were able to keep and hold them off and keep them from coming down and taking over that country. So the Assyrian Empire, The entire empire was wiped out by 609 BC, but it was not the Egyptians and the Hebrews that wiped them out. It was the Babylons and the Persians. They made an alliance, and they came together, and they destroyed the Assyrian Empire. And that brings us to the second period of history that's going to be covered in the book of Isaiah, which is 605 through 539 BC. And this is covering the rest of the book, these next two that we're going to talk about, these next two periods of history, chapters 40 through 66. So if the first period that we talked about was a political unrest and a spiritual mess, this one that we're going to be talking about now, 605 to 539, it was a time period where the Jews were scattered and they were sent into exile. Because here's what happens politically. So you have the Babylonian Empire that begins to come into power about 650 BC. They were the powerhouse in the world from 650 BC to 539 BC. Does anybody know who their famous king was? What's that? Yes, Nebuchadnezzar. You see what else we're overlapping with here? What other book are we overlapping with? Daniel, that's right. We are overlapping with Daniel at this point in the book of Isaiah. So Nebuchadnezzar comes into power. Jerusalem gets sacked and is destroyed in 586 BC. And Nebuchadnezzar had this policy that when he captured a land, he would start with their leaders, their key people, their educated people, the ones that would have been able to help organize and train and teach and help hold that culture together. And he would take them from where they were and send them off somewhere else so that they could be retrained and they would not be able to be where they could gather the people back together and do some type of revolt. So he had this policy of conquer, capture, and then disperse. And that's what he began to do. That's what we read in Daniel. Daniel was a young man that was trained in Babylonian ways. He would have known all of their literature, been able to speak their languages, known about their art. And I mean, he was trained that way. But we also know that he held on to his Jewish culture, right? We also know that from reading through Daniel. So that was Nebuchadnezzar's practice. So we had the spiritual condition at the beginning of Isaiah where, the people were giving themselves over to these other gods that they were encountering. They weren't being loyal to God. And, you know, you see in Isaiah 6 where Isaiah is called and accepts the call to go and to be God's voice. And God says to him, you're going to go be talking to a people that's not going to listen. They're not going to see what you have to teach them. They're not going to respond to what you have to say. What a horrible ministry. What a hard and horrible ministry to have to go through. So he's called to do that, and you know they wouldn't listen. And so the spiritual condition now, when we get to this next period of history, they have been sacked and scattered and sent to different places around the known world under King Nebuchadnezzar and the Babylonian Empire. Now they're in what we call the Babylonian captivity. And there were a lot of them that began to think that their faith was not real, that it was a farce. That this God that they had believed in, that they had heard all of these stories about who delivered their people, was not real. Because if he was real, why would he be allowing this to happen? Just remember now, they didn't listen to their prophet. And Isaiah was not the only prophet at this time, was he? Remember, we've talked about some other overlaps that were going on with some of the other prophets. And so they refused to listen to those that God sent to them to help them understand what he was trying to do and to call them back to themselves. So now you have Israel and the Jews scattered all over the known world. And while they're scattered, they've begun to think that their faith was false, that it was not worth holding on to. And so what you have happening is Israel, God, remember, these are God's people. He chose them. He called them out from among the other peoples in the world, established them as his kingdom, established this theocracy where he ruled and reigned among them. And he did it for the purpose of setting up this kingdom on earth so that all the other kingdoms and all the other peoples of the world would be able to know that there is a God, and through Israel they would receive God's self-revelation. They were the agent through which God was revealing himself to the rest of the world. So now they're scattered all over the place, and they're no longer, most of them are no longer interested in being that nation. They're no longer interested in being God's agent of self-revelation to the world. So that's the spiritual condition that we get into in the latter part of the book of Isaiah. And Isaiah is going to address these things for us in chapters 40 through 55. He's going to talk about this very situation. Well, these political powers don't seem to last very long, or at least when we're talking about them in the terms of history, they don't seem to last very long. Because after Babylon, does anybody know who comes next? Out of the ones we've mentioned, there's only one left. Persia. There you go. Persia is coming on the scene in 539, and they become the superpower under a man named Cyrus. So that kind of ends that period of Babylonian power, and the Persians come in, and so we get to the last part of the book of Isaiah, the last time period, 539 through 400 B.C. So the first part was this political unrest, this spiritual mess. The second part was the scattering and the exile. And now this third time period can be looked at as a remnant trying to return to God and return to Jerusalem and to Israel. Judah. So there's a man named Zerubbabel who tries to lead 50,000 Jews to return to Israel. Now, let's remember, King Nebuchadnezzar had this conquer and scatter the people. Cyrus had a different approach. Remember, he came in and they conquered, the Persians came in and they conquered everything that used to belong to the Babylonian kingdom. So now there's a new boss, there's a new ruler. He's got a different philosophy, a different way of doing things. And what he does, his policy is, I'm more likely to be able to rule people if they're content and they're happy. Seems like a good thing, right? So he would allow people to return to their homeland. So this man named Zerubbabel gets about 50,000 Jews together to go back to Jerusalem in order to, they want to rebuild the temple, they want to reestablish Judah, they want to reestablish their faith with God and their commitment to him. So they are leaving behind homes and businesses to go back. This was no small thing. 50,000 people following a man to go back and to reestablish their nation and to reestablish basically their religion again. That's a lot to leave and walk away from. You leave your home, you leave your business, you leave everything you own in order to go back and start up a group that wants to get into this relationship with God. Spiritual climate's shifting a little bit now, isn't it? Where they didn't want anything to do with God before, they felt that God had left, and now you've got some that are starting to realize that there is an importance, there should be an importance in their lives of coming together underneath God, the one who delivered them, coming back to Yahweh, coming back to worshiping him the way that he had established it, and getting back to his law. And so they take this journey, and they try to go back, and they get back to Jerusalem. Well, when they get there, things don't go so well for them. They're not received well. They had the heart and wanted to do it the right way, but the problem is the people that were already inhabiting Jerusalem when they got there weren't interested in it. And so their attempt to reestablish this nation under God of, and the temple worship was just met with a horrible failure. But there is some good news. 20 years later, Haggai and Zechariah, you guys recognize those names? They were able to find a group of people who were faithful, who were interested and wanted to do this, and they were able to rebuild the temple. And it was never rebuilt to the point of splendor that it was the time that Solomon reigned and that Solomon had it built. But nonetheless, these prophets were able to lead a faithful group of people in doing that. And so during this time period, here's what we have. We have three groups of people here. There are Jews who are deeply concerned about Judah, the nation of Judah, and its relationship to God. There are those that are really concerned about that. They want to see it reestablished. They understand that what God's word is, his law and his teachings are the way that they're supposed to live, and they want to live underneath that, and they want to reestablish that kingdom that is ruled by God himself. So that's the first one. The second one is that there are those that were concerned about the religion. They liked the religious part of it, but they had become in some way so wrapped up in the cultures that they had been, you know, had been sent to, had become, you know, had become so much a part of their lives, they weren't necessarily concerned about the relationship of the nation with God. They liked the idea of the religious practice, but they weren't necessarily interested in the relationship with God. So the third group are those that just didn't care for either one. So that's the spiritual climate and even the political climate getting near the end of Isaiah. And chapters 56 through 66 are going to cover that particular time period, and Isaiah is going to address the concerns that are that surround that remnant and the return of that remnant and how it relates to God. So that's the background. That gives you the political background, the time frame. You see the location of it all, and kind of the spiritual things that were going on there. So before we move on to the other things, are there any questions about that or comments about it? I love history. That's good stuff. It's good stuff. All right. A few other things about the book of Isaiah to give you some background on it before we are able to jump into it. Let's talk about who wrote it. Anybody know who wrote it? Isaiah. You can speak up. It's okay. Yes, Isaiah. Unless you ask some scholars who think that he didn't write it. Because there are some people who will tell you that he wrote part of it, but not all of it. That he wrote the first 39 chapters that we have today, and that the last part, chapters 40 through 66, some people believe Isaiah did not write that. And here's why. There seems to be, in some people's minds, a change in the style from chapters 1 through 39 and then chapters 40 through 66, because the latter part of the book is, it's more lyrical, it's more poetic, and it seems to be giving more of an exaltation than the first 39 chapters. Then there's the element of to whom he addresses the writing. There, in most of your prophets, they would speak and prophesy in a way that was applied directly to the people that they were talking to right then. The latter half of Isaiah seems to talk to people in the future, and that's different than what you see in most of the other prophets. And so some people take both of those things and try to I don't know how they I don't see it, but they try to finagle and say that Isaiah wrote the first part but not the second part. Here's why I don't think that is a reason to doubt Isaiah's writing of the whole book. Every concern that they have about 40 through 66, those chapters, whether it's the style or whether it's the way he addresses his prophecy to other people versus what he does in the first 39 chapters, those two things are not isolated to the last half of this book. In other words, there are instances in chapters 1 through 39 where his style shifts and changes and becomes more lyrical. I can give you a couple of examples of those if you want to look at them. Chapters 34 through 35, and also chapters 40 through 55. So there's some big chunks that seem to shift. Those two chapters, 34 and 35, seem to be similar to what you would see in chapters 40 through 55. You also have a different style in chapters 24 through 27 that stands out, and it's very apocalyptic. Remember, he's talked. One of the concerns they have is that the latter part of the book seems to talk to people in the future and not to the people right then, like most prophets did. Well, in those chapters 24 through 27, there seems to be some apocryphal stuff where apocalyptic things where he is speaking about things that are going to happen in the future. And so it's not isolated to the last half of the book. And based on that, I don't agree with these guys that would say this. I find no reason to doubt that Isaiah wrote the entire thing underneath the inspiration of God, giving him direct revelation as a prophet in order to speak to his people. So I hold that Isaiah wrote the entire book. Let's talk about some of the theology that shows up in this book. This Old Testament book is very rich in theology. I guess if you had to compare it to a chocolate cake, it would be a chocolate, you'd have chocolate cake with chocolate icing and then fudge poured on top of it and then chocolate chips sprinkled all over it and then with extra fudge. It's that rich in theology. You guys didn't seem like y'all liked that cake illustration. It's a good cake. What is going on? Does that sound good to you? So the theology in this, there's no other Old Testament book that comes that touches Isaiah when it comes to theology. The first thing that you're going to see and you're going to notice is the theology of God, which is theology proper. The way that he talks about God is unlike any other book in the Bible. He speaks of God with great wonder and awe. If you read in chapter 6 his response to God and the picture that he gives there of heaven, it's absolutely incredible. The things that he mentions about God, God is high and lifted up. He's the Holy One. The whole earth is full of his glory. You see in chapter 14, verses 22 through 23, where he speaks about the nations being under God's feet. One that is my favorite in chapter 45, verses 1 through 5, he talks about King Cyrus. Remember, this is the guy that's ruling Persia. Talks about him as being God's errand boy. Cyrus is supposed to be the ruler of the world at that point, and Isaiah clearly paints this picture that he may be a mighty ruler in the world, but he's still an errand boy to God. Then there are other little things all throughout this book where we see the character of God, and he contrasts it with the character of his people. And so where God is holy and God is lifted up, his people are unrighteous and they're lowly and they're sinners. You're going to see that all through this book. Another theological theme that comes through this through Isaiah is the idea of humanity in the world. We're going to see the fallen nature of mankind and of humanity as a whole. And in seeing that horrible side of humanity, when you compare right against it this other element that talks about humanity in the world, man, I love it. There's this, no matter how horrible humanity is, there's this sense in the book of Isaiah that it is worth redeeming. And that's a beautiful thing. That as horrible as mankind is, as horrible as we are, as sinful as we are worth redeeming. And sin's going to jump out at us in here. Isaiah is going to talk to us about it all through the book, but one of the interesting places to begin looking at it, which we will look at it next week, is in chapter 1, verses 2 through 3, where he talks about rebellion, and he talks about how stupid it is to rebel against God. That's a great summary of sin, the stupidity that we give ourselves over to when we are disobedient and rebel against God. Judgment and redemption is another thing that's going to pop out at us all through here. We're going to learn about the dependence of God when it comes to our redemption. And then there are entire sections of this book, chapter 10, chapter 30, chapter 42, and there's others, even chapter 43. There's places where big chunks where it talks about judgment, God's judgment on those that are disobedient. The overall theme of the book, I agree with several commentators that have written about this. The overall theme of this book is the idea of servanthood. So what we're going to see in Isaiah is that God's people are called to lay down any self-exaltation that they may have and be dependent on him. And the reason that God wants them to do that is because through his people, the world is supposed to see evidence of God's character. And they're supposed to understand that God is working to deliver humanity from its state of sin. And so that's the theme of servanthood here, is that we are supposed to give ourselves over to God, lay down any right that we think we may have to ourselves, and give our lives over to the Lord and to his teachings, and to do things his way so that we become this witness to the rest of the world, so that they can know the character of God through the way that we live our life and the way that we are obedient to him. And through seeing that, we get to be a living witness of what God is, of who God is and what God is trying to do. So that's the theme of the book. Well, in closing this out, let's talk about why all this matters today. Why, you know, start a study on the book of Isaiah by talking about these things that we've talked about tonight? Why not just jump in chapter 1 and just go? Well, like I said to begin with, you need to have an understanding of the background so that you know what's going to take place in this book and you're able to know the characters and the location and where everything's taking place. Now, that's the history of this book. And history is something that it's quite often overlooked in Christian circles today. And I think that's to our detriment because history teaches us a great deal about how God works. You see, God's not absent from our reality. He's not absent from our world. He's not absent from our time. God has chosen to work through history and to work through mankind in order to bring about his plan of redemption and to make himself known. And so it's important for us to be able to understand history. And when we talk about the political side of things here in the book of Isaiah, we need to remember these were men who were making political decisions that affected the lives of everyone in those nations. That hasn't changed today. Every decision that is made, every political decision that is made has spiritual and eternal consequences. That's biblical. Every political decision that's made has spiritual and eternal consequences. Now, why does that matter for us? When we study history, especially the history of the Bible, and we see decisions that men have made and how that worked out, and we understand that if we're not following God's plan for mankind and we're not following God's ways, then we end up in a mess. We end up under God's judgment. Nations end up under God's judgment, not just individuals, but entire nations. And that's important for you and for me because here in the United States of America, we have a right, we have the privilege to be able to go to the voting booth and have a voice in our government. We don't have a dictator that's ruling over us. We can go to the voting booth and we can vote that man or that woman out of office and pick the person of our choice and cast in our conscience a vote for the man that we think is going to do the right thing. So you and I need to take that privilege very serious. We need to take our civic responsibilities as believers very serious. So that's one of the things that we can learn in looking through Isaiah is that every political decision that is made, every political decision that we make, when we push a button in a voting booth, every decision that we make has a spiritual and an eternal consequence. We're about to go into an election year, aren't we? So that's something for us to really keep in mind. The second reason this all matters for us before we just jump off into chapter 1, verse 1, is that if we want to understand the New Testament and we want to grow as disciples, we've got to study and we've got to understand not just the verses in Isaiah, but we've got to understand the background of Isaiah so that we better appreciate what we're going to learn from the book. Here's why. There are 63 references to the book of Isaiah in the New Testament. No other book in the Old Testament is quoted more than the book of Isaiah. Not just in our New Testament, but in secular writings as well. Isaiah is quoted more than any other Old Testament book. 63 times in the New Testament. Jesus taught from the book of Isaiah in Luke chapter 4, verse 17. He takes that scroll, opens it up, and begins to teach from it. We see in Acts chapter 8, which we will get to sometime in the next few weeks, that the Ethiopian eunuch who was returning back to Africa was reading an Isaiah scroll when Philip encountered him, God brought him there, and Philip used the book of Isaiah to teach this man about Jesus Christ and led him through the gospel to faith in Christ using the book of Isaiah. And that man was baptized, and he took that Isaiah scroll and went back to Africa. Now, Luke doesn't give us any account. No, there's no biblical account of what happened after that guy got back to Africa, but it's very interesting that Northern Africa was one of the strong points for Christianity for centuries. So you have those encounters in the New Testament, Jesus teaching out of Isaiah, and the Ethiopian eunuch getting led to faith in Jesus Christ by reading and talking about the book of Isaiah. The last reason all of this matters to us is because if we're going to walk through this book and we're going to understand the concept of servanthood and how critical it is to our walk with Christ, then we need to be able to see in these people the fallen humanity, those that were rebellious against God. We need to be able to see ourselves in them. We need to be able to look at them and realize that, but by the grace of God, that would be us. So we need to understand their spiritual condition. We need to understand their heart, that they were rebellious against God, that they were prostituting themselves out to other gods and not being obedient to God, the one who created them, the one who delivered them. So we need to see ourselves in them. We need to realize that unless we are willing to be servants the way that God has asked us to be and to give ourselves over to Him, that's exactly the state that we are going to end up in, not only as individuals, but as a nation. If we are not willing as the church to be God's witness, God will close the church. He'll close the doors. He'll send us somewhere else. He'll be done with us. And if we as a nation are not willing to stand up for the things of God, God will be done with us. And just like these nations felt the judgment of God, as we're going to see in the book of Isaiah, our nation can feel that judgment as well. But while we're also talking about seeing ourselves in the bad side of humanity, we also need to be able to see ourselves through this redemption process and how we should relate to God. Because we're going to see God putting judgment out on His people, and every time He talks about judgment of Judah and sending them into exile and allowing them to go into exile, we need to remember that He saved a remnant for Himself and He redeemed them. Now, church, I want you to know that's who we are. Those of us that have placed our faith in Christ, we are God's remnant. We are the ones that He has called out of the world. We are the ones that He has saved. And so we need to be able to see through Isaiah this process of redemptive history that God has been playing out since the beginning of time and is still working out today in your life, in my life, in the lives of everyone here in Wichita Falls and around the world. This God's not absent. He's still here. He's still working through us. And He still desires to see redemption brought to all of humanity. So those are the reasons we needed to walk through what we walked through tonight, so that we have some background information that we can come in next week and we can begin looking at this book verse by verse, chapter by chapter, and walking all the way through it.